Today is October 15th, and we are pleased to welcome Robert Vandermolen to the Michigan Writers Series. I just read your book, actually. And I guess I wanted to start this. There are some general questions that we almost always ask people, which have to do with living in Michigan, because it's the Michigan Writers Series. But also, most of the time, every time, actually, until now, the readers have been academics. And this is the obvious difference, a notable difference between you and what usually comes through here, because you are a contract painter.
Well, I used to be a teacher,
though. Right. You taught at
years ago.
Grand Rapids Community College.
Right.
So why did you... I mean, eventually I'd like to hear about what the difference is between, you know, the life, the working life of the mind versus the working life of the body, which is obviously what painters do. I used to paint, too.
When I was teaching, basically I was teaching composition, and it was class after class after class and grading papers and standing in front of students all day long. And I thought, if I do this till I'm 65, I'm going to be nuts. So I just walked away from that job after 4 years. I just put an ad in the papers for painting just to pay my rent.
Mm-hmm.
And the nice thing about painting is I can daydream all day long.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing of standing in front of a class and having to be clever and answer questions. Mm-hmm. As far as I'm concerned, I'll make less money, but I can daydream all day long. It's preferable.
Or you might not make less money.
Well, I do. I know I do.
I suppose that's...
Luckily, my wife makes enough money to cover us with insurance and so forth.
Did you actually enjoy teaching?
Yeah, I did for a while. I mean, there's something nice to be said about having a captive audience.
Mm-hmm.
And you basically can say anything you want or try out ideas.
Mm-hmm.
But it just wore thin after a few years.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel like your classroom time was taking away, actually, or somehow impeding or infringing upon creative process or something like that?
Well,
because some people actually feel that way.
By the time school was out in May and I'd handed my grades, it would take me close to 4 or 5 weeks to relax enough to sit and read a book. In other words, I think it was a stress level I entered at the end of August into May, and I didn't realize it during the year until I did, you know, until you slow down in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing was, I was writing all the time, but my poems just became more and more clever.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's one of those problems of staying in front of a class. You have to be clever. And what happens, you go home and write, and the poems end up being clever.
And this is clever in a sort of bad way.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to be clever, really, to manipulate a class.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's tough to drop that cleverness when you sit down and try to write something.
Right.
I was becoming a clever academic poet.
Well, you're certainly not an academic now.
No.
So, and this is interesting. That is not to say, I did just read the book, which is not to say at all that the poems are not intellectual in any way, because they are. And these are extremely tightly written poems, I thought.
Hmm.
And I think I'm a pretty good reader anyway, and I had to read things several times to really see everything that was going on in the poems. So in some, you know, people might think that, okay, well, if people that don't work in the academy are therefore anti-intellectual, and that's certainly not true, is it?
Well, I read every night.
Yeah.
So during the day when I'm working, I can mull over the things I read the night before.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've been reading constantly since I was a child, so... In fact, I can probably read more now than when I was a teacher, because mm-hmm. then I had to read material to teach the class.
Right.
You know, and then tear poems apart mm-hmm. so I could teach that to the students, which was a pain in the butt.
Yeah. What do you find yourself reading these days? Do you read poetry?
Actually, poetry I read least of anything. I really enjoy reading history. And I read good novels. I even read trashy novels. I read detective fiction. Just whatever crosses my plate.
What kind of history?
I just finished Simon Sharma's book, History of Britain, Part 2, which I absolutely loved. I've read everything by Sharma.
I'm thinking of the work, which is not necessarily using history, but using memory. And hard to tell sometimes what is personal memory. I mean, that's the nature of fiction or poetry, but what is personal memory and what is so-called factual memory or factual...
Well, most of my poems are fictional. I had a friend here at Michigan State, Craig Sterry, who's still a friend. But I remember he published a poem, we're talking about 1966, 67. He published a poem someplace or other, and he showed me the magazine, and he had a line saying, "My wife and I driving through Pennsylvania." And I said, "How can you write that? You're not even married, you know." And he said, "Well, who cares?" And that was like an eye-opener for me. After that, I realized I could say anything I wanted to say. So I've always leaned more towards just making up anything that works, basically.
Well, why should poetry be any different than fiction, and why do you think people think it should be?
That's the way I was brought up. I mean, I up until 66, 67, I thought poetry had to be utterly factual, you know. It was like an enlightenment when I saw him make that thing up about being married. I thought, I can make anything I want up as long as it makes sense and as long as you stay emotionally honest, like a good fiction writer does.
Which is, of course, the mistake people make all the time too. Because you write a poem in the first person, people think that it's you.
Exactly. So I love to play around with different points of view. And sometimes the first person seems too strong, even if I made it up. So I can shift into second or third person and lessen whatever it is that was bothering me in the first person.
There's a lot of voice shifting. I mean, just between, I'll call them characters or voices in these poems. Too.
Yeah. I love playing around with that. And that's just another side of the whole fiction thing. I mean, if you can take... And the other thing is I like narrative, basically. And so a lot of my poems are just really small stories. I love playing around with points of view. And, you know, you throw in some personal things, but you mix them up so much with fictional things that it's just a stew, really.
Diane might say that you're making myth by mixing those things.
I don't know about that. I always thought Jim Harrison's a myth maker, but I don't think I'm in that league.
Yeah. Michigan. You've been living in Michigan now, and now you have two residences in Michigan, correct?
Well, we have a cottage.
One in the UP, yeah.
Oh, no, I have a cabin in the UP.
Yeah.
It's my grandfather's old hunting shack. So I've been going up there since before the Mackinac Bridge was built.
Wow.
We also have a cottage on Lincoln Lake where we spend our weekends in the summer.
Where's Lincoln Lake?
Oh, half hour north of Grand Rapids, up near, between Cedar Springs and Greenville, basically.
Well, you obviously participate quite a bit in what it means to live in Michigan. I mean, and you're a fisherman. You enjoy the outdoors, as good Michiganians do. The question I usually ask is, you know, how does that sort of affect the writing, the landscape of Michigan and whatnot? Because it seems to me, anyway, that people from the Midwest are a different kind of species than the East or West Coast, and I think that changes writing quite a bit.
Well, I've spent time on the East Coast and the West Coast, and it always struck me when I came back to Michigan, particularly, that there's a lot of material in Michigan that's never been written about. In other words, if you live in New York City, everybody and their brother's written about New York City, or San Francisco, or Northern California, or Oregon, Seattle. There's not much you can do that's kind of new out there. Mm-hmm. On top of which, there's more poets.
That's right.
I mean, I almost have a whole area just to myself. Is the way I think. Is the way I think of it.
Yeah.
I mean, just even place names. I mean, the funny thing is, there's an awful lot of poets from Michigan who would like to be thought of as not being in Michigan, or they're stuck in Michigan. Mm-hmm. And they don't use the place names, and they don't use the names of the rivers and so forth and so on, or the history. I mean, it's odd in a way.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's two things that come out of that. One might ask, if I'm allowed to say this, who would be interested in reading about Michigan if you're not from Michigan? And the other thing is that you are part of a community that is much smaller in terms of other people who write, just by population, if nothing else, and therefore, you know, what is your sort of?
Well, I think Jim Harrison sort of broke the ice on that years ago, becoming nationally, even internationally known for Michigan and remaining in Michigan until the last year.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I published a lot in England and East Coast and West Coast and. Mm-hmm. I've never been accused, as far as I know, of being provincial.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm talking partly about as a writer, who or what is your community in a place like Grand Rapids that doesn't?
Oh,
you know, that's not like New York City.
No. Well, there are poets in Grand Rapids, and we get together for parties and poetry readings and so mm-hmm. forth. But I communicate with people in other parts of the country as well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, email is just terrific in that regard.
It's so instantaneous, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a whole community that corresponds on email these days, and so it doesn't make any difference where you are.
Really? Well, you've got your papers coming to Michigan State University. The email thing is kind of disturbing to the archivist, who says, "What do you mean that this is all just happening on the email now? Are you printing your emails?"
Yeah, I print almost all of them.
Okay, good. All right, that's
in fact,
good.
I brought a huge batch today.
Yeah. Does everybody know that you're printing your emails and putting them on deposit in Michigan State?
Well, I mean, a few years ago, everyone was corresponding with letters.
Yeah.
I've always saved all the mail.
Yeah.
And now, actually, there's only two people who write letters anymore that I receive. And they know I'm keeping their letter. I'm just assuming people realize I'm keeping their emails. I mean, no one has ever said anything about it.
Who does not use email?
August Kleinzahler refuses to use email. And I've got another friend, a younger poet named Richard Lopez, who lives in Sacramento. And we've been writing back and forth for the last few years. And actually, he would prefer to email, but I told him I'd prefer to get letters.
Mm.
Because the problem is I'm getting too many emails these days.
Mm. How do you know August Kleinzahler? I'm kind of a fan of his work.
Huh. Well, back in the... I'm trying to think. It must have been back about 1983. I had a long poem published in the Epoch magazine out of Cornell, and he wrote me a fan letter.
Hmm.
And he sent it to the magazine. The editor sent it to me, and we started corresponding, and we've been corresponding ever since.
Yeah, nice.
And we got him up to Grand Rapids for a reading about 5 years ago. Hmm. We met for the first time, so and we had a good time.
Hmm. Excellent. Actually, that's about what I wanted to talk about.
Yeah.
So, anything you want to add? No, that's great. Look forward to the reading.
Yeah, good.